Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today is Town Meeting Day, an occasion that stands out both as a cultural tradition and also as an exercise in actually conducting local government affairs. Some people look forward to it as their annual civic duty. Others begrudge the fact that work prevents them from participating. But many Vermonters point to town meeting as an example of what makes Vermont special. The idea of Vermont's specialness, its exceptionalism, was the focus of a discussion we had on Vermont Edition last summer. As we take a break for town meeting today at noon, we'll listen back to that discussion about what qualities of our little state make Vermonters walk with a little extra pride in their step, and what aspects of life here deserve some stone-eyed scrutiny. Here are UVM Economics Professor Art Wolf and St. Michael's College Sociology Professor Vince Balduck.
Thanks, Jane. Good to be here.
So, you know, I say that Vermonters think Vermont, often think Vermont is the best place to live. And you do hear a lot of this, oh, Vermont's wonderful. Vermont's just unique kind of thing. But doesn't that happen everywhere? I mean, my family, a lot of them come from Maine. And I'll tell you, they think Maine is the best place in the world. So, Art, isn't this just wherever you live, you probably think it's wonderful?
I think that's true. If you didn't like where you lived, you probably wouldn't live there. You'd move if it was that bad. And so I think if you went to many places in the United States and you asked people, you know, do you enjoy living here? Do you think this is the best place to live? They'd probably say, well, yeah, I think so. Whether it's Wyoming or South Carolina or the Upper West Side of New York City, you'd probably get some very similar answers. Of course, we live here and we're surrounded by people who like living here. So that's what we hear.
So, Vince, there's nothing exceptional about Vermont's sense of exceptionalism?
Oh, there is. There is. There's a great deal that's exceptional about Vermont, particularly when you have a small area. It's inevitable that there'll be a lot of extreme scores that we have in a lot of things. And Vermont certainly does. And there's a great deal to be enthusiastic about when we talk about Vermont. In preparing for this program, I found something online that was sort of amusing. A large national real estate firm got a hold of Facebook data, and they asked them, they did a study about how many people listed their native state as a like. And it was quite interesting. Ohioans actually had a higher percentage of their population listing Ohio as a like than any other state in the United States, about almost 55%. And then the numbers dropped down to about 45%. And Vermont was number 7 with about 32% saying that we liked it. Interestingly, we think of Texans being very boastful about Texas. Texas was well below Vermont, and the lowest state was actually California, with only 20% of the population saying they liked living in California.
Although, you know, we have to take into context here, you know, Vermont, there's limited internet access in some places, and we have an aging population, not all of whom are on social media, so who knows if that's even accurate.
I would take this with a pound of salt, absolutely.
Yeah, and just to show you what surveys tell you, Gallup did a survey where they surveyed 600 people in every state, and they asked them, you know, how good is your state as a place to live? And Vermont was in the top 10. Texas was one of the highest, unlike Vince's.
Huh. So they may not like Texas on Facebook, but they like it when they live there.
Yeah, so you have to be very careful about surveys. You know, there's all sorts of biases when you have them, so take them with a grain of salt.
But there is something about this idea of Vermont exceptionalism that's been sort of transferred in our media. It's transferred in politics. It's something that's sort of spoken about as the Vermont way, you know, the Vermont way of doing things, the Vermont way of being. Vermont, I mean, we joke about it in the newsroom sometimes, that saying, well, Vermont leads the nation. You know, you hear that frequently, and I've lived in other places. I've lived in California, for example, where they would just roll their eyes if they really knew that Vermonters thought they led the nation, because I don't think everybody in California even knew where Vermont was, let alone thought of us as the shining beacon of leadership in the country. So are we delusional?
I think there's a bit of, I think, what the Greeks called hubris, you know, some false pride in the way we see ourselves, that, you know, we'll do something in all 50 states, and indeed all 300 or 220 nations of the world will look to Vermont and say, oh, yeah, they're doing it, and it must be right, and so we'll follow them.
When we are first, even when we have things like the first state to pass in a legislative way, same-sex marriage, for example, that was another time when Vermont said, look, we're a leader in this.
And there are issues like that where we do lead the nation, and there's others where we're way behind the nation. I mean, remember, we have no gun control. If you want to think of that as something that, you know, we should lead the nation on, well, we lead the nation in not having any gun control laws and allowing people to carry concealed firearms without a permit. I think the rest of the nation probably wouldn't want to follow Vermont in those areas, and a lot of Vermonters are probably appalled to think that that's part of our state's ethos as well.
Boy, and that's one that you're going to get people on both sides of that debate. I mean, some people would say Vermont is a leader in that, while others would say this is abhorrent.
So a lot of it is really judgment. What do you think is important? A lot of people would be appalled to think that we allowed same-sex marriages before any other state. So it really is a bias of what people are like. And people who do like are in very much in favor of, say, same-sex marriage, they tend to live here because they like it. If they didn't like it, they'd probably be so upset they'd move. And people in South Carolina or Alabama, just the opposite.
All right, listeners, we do want to get your take on this. We want to hear what you think about this idea, the myth, perhaps, of Vermont exceptionalism. You can post your thoughts at vpr.net. We got a note from artist Sabra Field of East Barnard, who emailed in to say, it's not a myth, of course. Vermont exceptionalism is our cherished condition of living on the edge of too cold, too remote, too poor, and in my opinion, too many trees. Our gentle yet magnificent landscape, now classed as good enough to constitute a national park in itself, is the result of efforts at survival that have given us a visual culture of villages surrounded by agriculture, backed by mountains, that persists in the 21st century because it's grounded in a belief in shared responsibility for each other. Saberfield says, let's celebrate a place beyond time that keeps its eye on the future, and with respect for Native Americans who've lived in harmony with the forest, let's keep our hard-won fields and pastures open too. We do have people who are sharing thoughts of a more negative sense as well. I got a note from Sarah who says, I do love this state that I grew up in and returned to for all of the obvious reasons that people always talk about. But I also think that focusing on how great it is can distract us from what is not so great. I have friends of color and friends from other areas who have not felt remotely welcome here. Because I love Vermont, I wish every kind of person felt comfortable here. High hopes, I know. I've been heartened by the concern around drug use. Hopefully this highlighted concern results in changes. I wished we faced more of our issues straight on. And Vince Baldock, maybe you can address what Sarah's talking about there with friends of color, friends from other areas, friends who may not fit the somewhat homogeneous nature of Vermont, perhaps feeling excluded. But that homogeneous nature of Vermont actually is something that we should highlight as one of the concepts here that is part of this Vermont exceptionalism and part of the data on Vermont.
Yeah, absolutely. Our very small size and our homogeneity are two very remarkable, very distinctive. I mean, we can say exceptional in one sense, in another sense, maybe we just ought to say distinctive. Our tiny size. Remember, we're only about the size, well, we're within 1,000 people of the size of the Springfield, Massachusetts metropolitan area. You know, we're both about 600.
We're kind of an average-sized county, really.
That's right. Or a medium-sized city.
Yeah.
But we're remarkably, for reasons that Art talked about with regard to migration and a couple of other characteristics, homogeneous in the way that we demographically exist, but also in some of the ways that we think. There's a selective migration of people here. Vermont does not look like America, not even close. If one were to look for a state that looked like America, you'd probably pick Illinois, which really reflects it very well, and thus the saying, how would it play in Peoria, Illinois? There are other states that are also very small and also have distinctive identities. Mississippi, Utah, these are very distinctive places. Vermont's distinctive for some other reasons. We do have the lowest proportion of minorities, Latinos, African Americans, Asian Americans. We're 12th in that. Latinos are actually second in the nation in terms of proportion. African Americans third.
You mean third lowest?
Third lowest in proportion. Yeah,
and
not
immigrants
highest.
As well.
And immigrants also. Yeah. That's right. And that's also reflected in the dominance of the English language. Only 5% of Vermonters don't speak a language other than English at home, and the national average is 20%. So,
but only 5% do speak a language other than English at home
in Vermont. Nationally, the figure is 20%. So there's really a big difference. It's a homogeneity that makes it easier for us to feel like we're a community, to feel close. It reduces anonymity. We oftentimes like sameness, so we're more comfortable with it, but we're a little bit too comfortable.
Art, your thoughts on that?
I'd like to kind of take what Vin said and more focus on some of the statistical ends of things. So the smallness is really important and the homogeneity. And when we look at some of the reasons we think we're exceptional, we have the lowest or second lowest unemployment rate in the nation, you know, one of the lowest poverty rates in the nation. You know, those kind of statistics come out, one of the lowest infant mortality rates in the nation. But we are homogeneous. And if you say, well, let's compare Vermont to the non-minority population in the United States as opposed to the nation as a whole, because the nation as a whole, 25 to 30% of the nation's population are minorities. And in Vermont, it's about 4 or 5%. So when you do that, instead of having, well, we can't really do the unemployment rate in terms of ranking, but our unemployment rate is far below the national average. If you look at our unemployment rate compared to the non-Hispanic white unemployment rate, about half of the difference vanishes. If you look at our infant mortality rate compared to the non-Hispanic white infant mortality rate, about half the difference vanishes. So we start getting much closer to national average. Many of them were still better than the national average, but it's not like we're way, way out on an extreme in a good sense. We're kind of average or a little bit better than average in some of these indicators, but it really makes Vermont look more reasonable, more normal than the state that must be just doing everything right to have all these great indicators.
You talked about that actually recently in a VPR commentary that you did where you took a look at the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Kids Count survey that ranked Vermont very high in children's health. And you said, well, hang on a minute. If you're comparing, you know, basically non-Hispanic white people to non-Hispanic white people, Vermont does look a lot more average.
Right. And that's true not just of the Annie E. Casey Kids Count, but a lot of other economic and demographic variables that we like to look at to see how well we're doing in the biggest possible sense of how well, what we mean by how well we're doing, not just income, but all these health and socioeconomic indicators.
Well, and that's a fairly sad statement on what's happening in America when you can break apart rankings like that based on race, as one example that we're talking about now, and look at non-white minorities in America really not faring as well, and Vermont faring better because we have such a high population of white people. I mean, Vince, that's not a happy statistic any way you look at it.
Oh, not at all. No, it's quite troubling. And it extends to many things. You talked about health, demographic things, economic things, educational things, crime things. Mm-hmm. All sorts of matters are profoundly affected by our social and economic background and this thing we call ethnicity or race. Some are a little surprising, like the suicide rate, for example. We have a fairly high suicide rate, and people think because of mud season. So it's not true. There's no increase around mud season and stuff. But the white rate is very high compared to the minority rate. Minorities have very low rates of suicide. And so Vermont has a higher suicide rate. We're about 13th highest because we have more whites.
Well, we're talking today about how Vermont fares when we start thinking about ourselves as exceptional, when we start comparing ourselves to other states. We're trying to take a kind of a broad look at this today, and we're interested in hearing from many of you about your thoughts on Vermont exceptionalism. Whether you live here or maybe you're listening from outside the borders of the state and you have an outsider's perspective that you'd like to share, Sina posted on Facebook saying, I'm part of a boomerang club of Vermonters. We get itchy, roam the world, and then realize we just want to be back in Vermont over and over again. I keep finding that there is nowhere else that I fit, or more accurately, where I don't have to fit. Armin says, no exceptionalism, just a leader in many areas, and okay, a laggard in some, with successes and failures, but more successes, though. And Andrew says, things would be even better if we stopped glorifying dairy and cleaned up Lake Champlain. Rivers flowing into the lake aren't supposed to be chocolate brown, so lots of different perspectives there. Please share yours at vpr.net. We're going to get much deeper into your thoughts coming up here on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. And Vermont is the best! Or is it? Maybe we're just average. I mean, great, really, but not exceptional. All right, today we're taking a look at the myth of Vermont exceptionalism, getting a robust defense of it from some of you saying we're not all that exceptional. And we're looking at how statistics can, in some cases, mislead us into thinking we're more exceptional than perhaps we are if we look at them in a different context. If you'd like to share your perspective, you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You can read what others are saying there as well. But again, our number 1-800-639-2211. We're also getting some analysis on the statistics that are often bandied about to prove Vermont exceptionalism. We're talking with St. Michael's College sociology professor Vince Balduck and UVM economics professor Art Wolf. And let's read a couple of emails here. Eric says, if you think that Vermont is special even when dealing with its not uncommon climate nastiness, you probably appreciate all it has to offer in all seasons. This, I think, is a common trait of most residents. The warmth of the people here has always amazed me, living in a climate that would drive many people nuts. Maureen says Vermont isn't just a state. It is a community, progressive on human rights issues, environmental issues, and human health. It promotes both personal responsibility and community support. Add to that the incredible natural areas that are becoming increasingly hard to find in a country of big box stores and suburban sprawl, the absence of billboards, and a highly creative population. Now, if we could only tackle the lack of affordable housing. And then we got a note from Lamoille Lamenter, who says, Vermont, in my experience, has been a horrible place to live. There is no or little pride in homeownership. Instead of paying a fee to bring one's junk to the dump, the common practice is to put it in your lawn marked free. Further, native Vermonters are very unwelcoming to outsiders. All right, some different takes there. And let's go to Robert calling in from Burlington. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi. So I grew up in North Dakota. I lived in New Jersey and New Hampshire and Maine and a little bit in Massachusetts and a little bit in California. And compared to all of that, so I know the kind of the rural and I know living in populated areas. Right now I live in Burlington, the most populous town in the state. And speaking for both the town and the state, I think that both have an extremely high cool per capita ratio is how I would put it. I think that that's a legitimate measure because the fact that the number of people is as small as it is, we have these natural resources that are relatively undamaged. I know that there is issues with runoff in the lake, but the lake is still quite clean. I swim in the lake still. All the time. And from a political point of view, I'm just tickled pink with this state. Folks like Bernie now, he's thinking of running for president, and Howard Dean when he ran for president. We were the first state to have civil unions, and we'll probably be the first state to have single-payer health care. You know, so just for my money, this state has the highest cool per capita ratio of them all.
Robert, thanks for your comments. Appreciate that. And I want to pick up on what you're saying here about size. And Vince Balduck, I know that you do too. In fact, Vince, we once had you on a show that we called the Per Capita Show. And all we talked about was how Vermont ranks per capita and what that actually means. So could you pick up the ball there that Robert handed you?
Sure. I mean, he's absolutely right that size matters. It does make a difference. With our small size, we have a rather outsized aspiration about many things. When I compare Vermont to, say, Springfield, Massachusetts, that metropolitan area just 40 minutes south of our border, I can't imagine they're having the same types of aspirations we do, like a major national or world-class university, a medical school, a world-class medical school, and a whole bunch of other things.
But we don't have the Basketball Hall of Fame, though.
we don't have the Basketball Hall of Fame, that's right. But it's kind of amusing when you go to a national conference as a representative of something in a state or in our professional associations, and you meet your counterpart at another state, from another state, and they say, oh, you're the representative of this. Where's your secretary? Where's the people who follow you? Where's all your support network? Well, it's me. That's all there is. And they have a whole bevy of people who support them and do all this stuff. And so it's kind of amusing.
But I think people might find the same thing about legislators, too, that most legislators
Sure.
in Vermont, they answer their own emails, they answer their own phones, they don't have a staff.
Absolutely true. And also, you know, the culture kind of affects people who come here even in the summer. One of my favorite small Vermont stories, and I think we all have, was of the Burlington Free Press reporter who wanted to talk to William Rehnquist when he was alive. And she said, well, how can I do that? I know he's a summer resident. So she looked in the White Pages and dialed William Rehnquist, and he answered his own phone. The other aspect of small size is that we have the highest percentage of a rural population, which means just living in communities of 2,500 or less. It doesn't mean farm. But when we have 61% of our population in such small communities, you have to know many of the people. Many of the decisions are made locally. A lot of them have to be done voluntarily, and so we have high rates of volunteerism. You have to be nice to people. You have to have this culture of niceness because, you know, they are going to coach your son's soccer league or you're going to see him again. And so anonymity is, you know, is doesn't affect us in the same way that it does in a large city. We have to be nice to people. We have to take responsibility more. And that really is different than some of the other things. It really does contribute to a special way of life.
And in fact, you probably know the dog catcher in your town.
Absolutely.
So if your dog is running riot, you know, you're going to get the call from Bob saying,
right.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah,
and you know, when you talk about rural and Vermont being a highly rural state, I think it's interesting just to put a point on that what we're talking about, what that designation actually means is communities, as you said, of fewer than 2,500 people, not necessarily how spaced out we are. There are other states that are more spaced out that have fewer people per capita than Vermont does, but it's about rural towns.
Yeah, take a state like Montana, which doesn't have a whole lot more people than Vermont, but is probably 10 or 20 times the size. That is very have a low density of population, but there's probably more cities over 40,000 in Montana, a lot more than Vermont has. So we have to be, you know, careful about this rural idea versus density.
Right.
But I think, you know, the point that being small does make you different is important.
Let's go to Jake, who's calling in from Colchester. Hi, Jake. Go ahead.
Hey, Jane and Robert. I didn't get your other guest name. How's it going, guys?
Good. We have Vince and we have Art.
Okay. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about why I think we feel Vermont's so exceptional. And I think a lot of it is because if you look around the country, you know, out west, you've got drought going on. You've got major natural catastrophes that strike at any moment. And here in Vermont, we're really safe. We don't have to experience any of that. And it stays so beautiful here because of the environment. I think part of the reason why it's so safe here is also part of the problem. You know, we don't have a lot of high-paying jobs. It's not a very industry-friendly state, which I'm completely okay with. I just feel that Vermont is quickly becoming a place that's not very friendly for the Vermonter. You know, we're running out of high-paying jobs, and people that are being educated here at some of our better universities are having to look for careers elsewhere and having to move out of our state.
Jake, I'm going to grab what you're saying there because, Art Wolf, you've talked about that a lot, about the economics of Vermont. And when we look at some statistics that rank Vermont very high, there are other economic statistics that don't always rank Vermont very high.
Right. Well, on the good news side, if you look at our average incomes, we're a little bit above the national average in many indicators, median household income, median family income, and that's really the first time in our history that we've been above the national average. However, getting back to something we talked about earlier, if you compare Vermont to the non-minority, the non-Hispanic white averages, then we're a little bit below. So you have to be very careful on that. In terms of the jobs and that issue, one thing that's real interesting is if you think that Vermont is exceptional, then the question you want to ask is, well, why don't more people move here? Why aren't all 300 million Americans living here? I wouldn't like that. But more seriously, if we look at where people move, I mean, if people are making decisions based on their mobility, you know, vote with your feet, essentially, then we should be very concerned because for the last probably 10 years, more people have moved out of Vermont than have moved in, which tells you that there must be something wrong here. Now, maybe it's a lack of jobs, but even if this is a wonderful place to live and we love it despite mud season, It tells us that when people weigh all these different factors that are important to them, the weight is heavily on we're going to leave because more people are leaving than coming here, and that should disturb all of us.
Well, and that points out a really interesting conundrum that we have here, which is that part of what we value is also what makes it a challenge for people to be able to live here. You know, that rural nature, that sense of having agriculture, having environmental standards, having places that are wide open spaces also means that we don't necessarily have industry. We don't have some of the jobs that other places do have.
Well, actually, our job structure is very similar to the nation as a whole. We're really not that much different. Agriculture is tiny, but it's tiny nationally. 2% of Vermonters work in agriculture. Nationally, it's 1.5%. So it's pretty small.
Okay, so what is it then, Art?
Well, I think it's getting back to what Vince was talking about, it was size. With small size means fewer opportunities. I mean, if you have some sort of specialized job skills, and we're all specialized nowadays. Some of us are VPR announcers, and some of us work behind the stage there. but you have very specialized skills, and if there's only one place where you can work, then you're going to be really reluctant to move to that place because if you don't like your job or if you get fired, where are you going to go? Whereas if you're in a big city, a metropolitan area, there's lots of opportunity. So that small size that we think is so wonderful also has a lot of negatives.
So you're saying if VPR gets rid of me, I don't have any other choice. I got to move out of Vermont?
I don't know. Do you like country music?
Let's go to Richard calling in from Westmore. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
The way I see it, I've been here for about 21 years in Vermont, and I love the state. I used to come as a child, and I'm African American. I find that there are two Vermonts. One is where I live in the Northeast Kingdom. Obviously, is particularly the culture is totally different as the major urban eastern portion of the state, as you will know. I find that we have people coming into the state who are fairly well off or are taking very relatively good jobs. But then there's a section of the state that lags. And so, yes, the density is different as well. But the way I look at it is the cost of living here is high given the tax structure. That's one thing. The other thing, too, is it's difficult to generate a job. The entire country is in the process of actually trying to develop more jobs, but here in particular, because we're small, because we are the densities are less.
Yeah, Richard.
Then it's that much more difficult.
I hear what you're saying. I appreciate that point, and I particularly appreciate what you were saying at the beginning. You think there are two Vermonts, and you could split those two Vermonts in a lot of different ways. You know, you could split rich and poor, or well-off and not well-off. You could split geographically as well. You often hear people talk about Chittenden County is a nice place right next to Vermont. So there's Chittenden County and the rest of Vermont. So there are a lot of different ways that we can split it. We talk about Vermont as a whole here, Vince, but not everybody is thinking of the same Vermont when we talk about Vermont.
Absolutely right. In the research that we've done, statewide polls, it's just inevitable that every time we do the statewide poll, we come up with two Vermonts in various ways. I think Richard's right on the money. And the Chittenden County versus rest of the state difference is really kind of a chasm of difference in many different ways.
Are it economically different as well?
Yeah, I mean, Chittenden County, by national standards, as small as it is, but by Vermont standards, as big as it is the economic leader of the state. It's growing, even though it's not growing fast. It's growing population-wise. This economy is growing. The rest of the state essentially is losing population or is stagnant, and it's much harder for businesses to grow or develop there, much less opportunities for people. So outside of Chittenden County, it's tough.
I want to see if we can just squeeze one more call in here while we're on this topic. Tom's on the line with us from Waitsfield. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. Good to talk to you all. And Jane, I wanted to thank you especially for using data to help drive a conversation. I think the more we do that, the more we learn about our state and our lives. And
well, we have Vince and Art to thank for that, I have to say. But, right. Tom, go ahead. We're short on time.
Okay. I just emailed you a few minutes ago the results of a random survey of Vermont, of happiness and well-being in Vermont, which was conducted by the Center for Rural Studies. And it shows that in all 10 domains of well-being that we measured, that Vermont is slightly ahead of the national in all 10 areas. Top two were social connection and environmental quality, and the bottom two, the bottom of the line was governance and time balance were the least good categories, but we led the nation in all of them.
Oh, interesting, Tom. Thanks for that. So it looks like Vermont is a place that is happy in addition to all of the other things that we've talked about. One more email here as well. Carrie posted on Facebook to say, it's usually outside people who remind me of Vermont's exceptionalism. I was on a group camping trip in Maine recently, surrounded by Bostonians, Mainers, and folks from New Hampshire. And without exception, whenever I said I was from Vermont, people would sigh and smile dreamily and say, oh, I love Vermont. I do too, Carrie says, but it's easy to forget the longing that people have for it. All right, we're going to leave it there, but this conversation, obviously ongoing, people always talking about where they live and what it means to be from Vermont, what it means to live in Vermont, and it's always important to look at our statistics and what they actually tell us about ourselves. So for that, I really want to thank UVM Economics Professor Art Wolf and St. Michael's College Sociology Professor Vince Bolduc. Thank you again for having the conversation with us. Always appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure.
I had a good time. Thanks, Jay.
We've been listening back to a discussion we had last summer on Vermont's sense of exceptionalism. Today is Town Meeting Day in Vermont, one of those days that really does set the state apart from others in how it conducts its business. Tonight, live at 7 o'clock, VPR News brings you special coverage of Town Meeting results, and we want your participation. You can call in live or connect with us on social media to share the results from your town's meeting. The coverage begins live at 7 o'clock tonight on VPR. Coming up on this show, while Town Meeting does loom large in Vermont's iconography, so does a certain 20th century painter. The life and work of Norman Rockwell is just ahead on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There are a handful of people whose names have an iconic status here in Vermont. People like Ben and Jerry, Fred Tuttle, and Norman Rockwell. Rockwell spent a lot of years painting in the town of Arlington, and his homespun images that appeared on the covers of the Saturday Evening Post are closely associated with the rural character of Vermont. But in a biography of Rockwell, writer Deborah Solomon described the internal life of the man as quite different from the reassuring images he gave to the world. We spoke with Solomon when her book, American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell, was published in 2013.
Who was Norman Rockwell? A lean, bluish man with a Dunhill pipe, his features arranged into a gentle mask of neighborliness. He went on television talk shows and came across as sane and personable, a Cracker Barrel philosopher in a tweedy jacket and bow tie, chuckling heartily, the famous pipe jutting. But behind the mask lay anxiety and his fear of anxiety. On most days, he felt lonesome and loveless. His relationships with his parents, wives, and three sons were uneasy, sometimes to the point of estrangement. He eschewed organized activity. He declined to go to church. For decades, he had a lucrative gig providing an annual painting for the Boy Scouts calendar, but he didn't serve as a troop leader or have his own children join the Scouts. He was more than a bit obsessive, a finicky eater, whose preferred dessert was vanilla ice cream, he once made headlines by decrying the culinary fashion for parsley. He wore his shoes too small. Phobic about dirt and germs, he cleaned his studio several times a day. He washed his brushes and even the surface of his paintings with ivory soap. As he grew older, it occurred to him that he was spending a greater proportion of his time cleaning up and a diminishing proportion of his time at his easel. He joked that one day he would only clean up.
And in fact, that's sort of how it turned out in the end. In one day, he wasn't so much painting as pottering around
the
studio cleaning up.
That's true.
you know, it's not the picture of Norman Rockwell that people expect if what they expect is what he painted, you know, if they think he was painting from his own life.
And he also, of course, cultivated that image of a friendly, regular guy who was just like his neighbors. He really didn't let on about his private life much during his own lifetime.
You do go on in that introduction to say, though, that Rockwell really did believe in the redemptive power of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And that is, of course, how we all think of him. He had these one-panel stories. They told a whole story in one painting. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't his life, what was it about stories and storytelling that so appealed to him?
Fascinated me. I visited the house in Arlington. And I looked out his bedroom window at that fabulous village green. We all know it, right? Everyone in Vermont knows that famous red-covered bridge in Arlington, Vermont, where Norman Rockwell lived. And he saw that view every day, and he never painted it.
Never
and
painted it a single landscape his whole time in Vermont.
That's true. That is true. But, I mean, and, you know, we had that picturesque scene right in front of his house. It is just quintessential New England peacefulness. And that was so, looking out the window, I felt so moved thinking about how he did live amid a beautiful landscape, but really, really conceived all the subjects of his art in his imagination. And being in his house drove home that point for me. He certainly dreamed up his scenes and did not base them on reportage. Some people saw him, they thought he was like Walter Cronkite reporting on country life and giving us scenes that were actually taking place. But he was no news reporter. He was a true artist in the sense that his work, I think, really sprang from his inner dreams and from a sense of emotional necessity.
Deborah Solomon, you say true artist. He was a true artist. Mm-hmm. What he did was the mark of a true artist. Mm-hmm. But he was very careful not to call himself an artist. He called himself an illustrator. Mm-hmm. Why the distinction? Was that wasn't just his distinction. Mm-hmm. That was a distinction that a lot of people were making.
Mm-hmm. Well, for one thing, he was an extraordinarily modest man. And he called himself an illustrator because he didn't want to imply that he intended his work for anyone besides the readers of the Saturday Evening Post and the other magazines for which he provided covers. So he hardly would have claimed that his painting could hold its own next to a Jackson Pollock or an Edward Hopper or the other greats of American art. He also called himself an illustrator because his work was technically illustration. And unlike other illustrators in Vermont, including his friends John Atherton and many others, he had no interest in exhibiting his art in art galleries and becoming part of the art world. And I think you can attribute that to his modesty and also his inability to work without a deadline. He needed the deadline in order to produce.
Yeah, you say when he tried, he did try over the years, and he would go to Europe and see what the different trends were, and then he'd come home and try to be a, quote, real artist, and it just wouldn't work.
No, he couldn't do it. And one of my favorite stories is that one of his sons one night wasn't feeling well and asked him to draw a picture of a clown just to amuse his son. And Rockwell said, but I don't have a model here. How could I possibly draw a clown? You know, he came out of the tradition of figure painting. He was very much a figure painter as opposed to a landscape painter. And he studied at the Art Students League where he drew from the model, which is the foundation of all art education. That's how artists traditionally were trained. You went to school, there was a plaster cast of a human figure, you drew it. Later you graduated to life class. He had a very traditional art background and decided to use his great draftsmanly skills as an illustrator.
He did, though, incorporate different artistic styles into his paintings. You write he loved the Dutch masters, and if you look at some of his paintings, he has that really intricate interplay of light and darkness and some very rich undertones. I mean, you look at his paintings and say, these are works of art. These weren't hastily sketched illustrations to make a buck. I mean, it took him months to do these paintings.
Right. That's what nobody understood. He was actually losing money on his Saturday Evening Post covers. You know, other artists who lived in Greenwich Village in the 50s thought, oh, he sold out. He's making a lot of money. He makes magazine covers. But he would actually lose money on those covers because he was such a perfectionist, and they took him so long to complete. And he supported himself by doing other gigs beyond the magazine covers, such as his annual calendar for the Boy Scouts. That was his most lucrative work, and he didn't particularly enjoy it.
He did some advertising work as well. Did he never make enough money in his own lifetime to be able to not do that work?
He needed the advertising work to support himself because he had a very expensive life. As you know, his whole family was in therapy at various points. He had enormous medical bills and certainly did not support himself mainly from his magazine covers. No.
We're listening back to our interview with Norman Rockwell biographer Deborah Solomon. Her 2013 book is called American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. Rockwell's process of drawing multiple drafts from photographs to create a painting is well documented. We asked Solomon about Rockwell's process.
I've determined, based on my serious research, that he had the most labor-intensive technique of any artist who ever lived. You know, he really had so many steps. It was incredible. And did so many drafts of an image before the final painting. And I have thought, I've often wondered, why did he subject himself to such a punishing routine? And I think it's a fascinating artistic question and also a fascinating psychological question. I think generally, you know, we think of artists as people who just kind of release all their energy, spill everything onto canvas. But in his, he worked the opposite way, and he somehow managed to create great art by reining in his instincts and controlling himself and controlling his art to a great degree. And I think that's one of the fascinations of his art. Every detail is there because he wanted it there. And that's why I find I could spend endless time with my most educated art friends discussing his paintings, what they mean, what just even the Thanksgiving painting, the famous Freedom from Want. I just spent an hour discussing it with an art critic the other day. The paintings are really complicated, and it's partly because his process was so intense.
You do write, though, that some people who would say, I posed for Freedom from Want or I posed for this painting were surprised to hear that seven or eight other people in town had also posed for that painting that they thought they were the one model for.
Right. The model is always the last to find out. A lot of people were crushed when they realized that they posed and they didn't necessarily see their face on the cover of the post. He tended to use multiple models, although that also allows people to take credit for having posed for pictures that they may or may not have actually posed for. It's unclear sometimes who the model is.
Well, you talk about Rockwell and looking at his childhood and growing up and, you know, that he was in some ways a little bit of an underdog. He could be called a wimp in the parlance of that day. You know, he was overshadowed by his athletic brother.
Exactly.
He tried to pretend that he was lame at one point just to get some attention. And he comes across as kind of a complainer and a difficult person to live with despite his very charming public image.
Complainer. No one's used that word yet. That's exactly right. He did suffer from a lot of ailments. He complained a lot about not feeling well. It's funny because I interviewed one shrink who actually lived in his house with him in 1959, a man named Anthony Phillip. And I said, what did Rockwell talk about in his sessions? And he said, well, he would just complain about his health. And I said, there must be more than that. He goes, no, no. He would say, you know, he had a cold and it won't go away.
Well, he also became so
in his childhood, you said, yes, that he had an older brother who was very athletically gifted and academically gifted. This was his older brother, Jarvis, not to be confused with his son, Jarvis, who's an artist living in the area. He felt very vanquished and defeated by his childhood and really through his work kind of was always trying to connect with a rugged boy. He loved the vision of boyishness and in many ways was a poet of American boyhood. And in both his life and his work, in fact, he seemed to derive tremendous consolation and happiness from visions of boyhood that were very different from the sort of boyhood he actually had in New York and in Mamaroneck, New York.
So looking at some of Rockwell's later artwork, this was part of what you kind of described, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but really is sort of his late phase. And he became a much more overtly political painter. It was partly timed with when he left the Saturday Evening Post, and he was doing illustrations for Look magazine that had a little bit more of a political flavor. But what do you think it was about him beyond that that made him make the shift and say, actually, I'm going to use my artwork for political means?
Well, I think it was a confluence of factors. Number one, he really believed in equality and was appalled by discrimination. So that was one of his basic values. And his work is always about people showing respect for one another. I think he really wanted people to listen to one another and look at one another when they spoke and respect one another as individuals. So that, of course, was one of the basic instincts of his work. But I think he was moved to embrace the civil rights movement in the 60s by probably under the influence of his therapist, Eric Erickson, who was a great political liberal and who gave him the courage to not follow the Post's directives and to be more himself in his work.
That's Deborah Solomon, author of the biography American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. You can learn more about Rockwell and explore VPR's reporting on his life and career in Vermont, including interviews with Vermonters who sat as models for Rockwell and the incredibly high prices some of his paintings have fetched at auction. All of that is online at vpr.net. Today is Town Meeting Day in Vermont, and this evening, VPR News brings you live coverage of results from across the state, and we want your participation. You can call in live or connect with us on social media to share the issues and results from your town's meeting. The coverage begins live tonight at 7 o'clock here on VPR. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Rick Singeri. Our production team also includes Peter Biello, Mary Williams, Aaron Lucy, and Devin Karambulis. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.